Side 4. All Tomorrow's Parties by William Gibson. Continuing on page 127. We are concerned, Faust went on, that Mr. Laney, for reasons of health, will be unable to continue. We number among us some who are possessed of his talent, but none to such an extraordinary extent. Should Laney be lost to us, Mr. Rydell, we fear that little can be done.
Jesus, said Rydell, you think I know what you're talking about?
I'm not being deliberately gnomic, Mr. Rydell, I assure you. There is no time for explanations now, and for some things it seems there may actually be no explanations. Simply remember what we have told you, and that we are here for you at this address. And now you must return immediately to wherever you have left the projector.
And they were gone.
And the back courtyard with them, compacted into a sphere of pink and green fractal neon that left residuals on Rydell's retinas as it shrank and vanished in the dark behind the Brazilian sunglasses. 30. Another one. Fontaine had spent most of the late afternoon on the phone trying to lay Clarice's creepy Japanese baby dolls off on a decreasingly likely list of specialist dealers. He knew it wasn't the thing to do in terms of realizing optimum cash, but dolls weren't one of his areas of expertise. Besides, they gave him the horrors, these another one replicas. Specialist dealers wanted low wholesale, basically, so they could whip the big markup to collectors. If you were a collector, Fontaine figured, specialist dealers were nature's way of telling you you had too much money to begin with. But there was always a chance he'd find one who knew somebody, one specific buyer to go to. That was what Fontaine had been hoping for when he'd started dialing. But now it was 8 calls later, and he was reduced to talking to this Elliot in Biscayne Bay, Florida, who he knew had once been put under electronic house arrest for something involving counterfeit Barbies. That was a federal rap, and Fontaine ordinarily avoided people like that, but Elliot did seem to have a line on a buyer, although he was, as you'd naturally expect, cagey about it. Condition, Elliot said. The 3 salient points here are condition, condition, and condition.
Elliot, they look great to me.
Great is not on the NAADC grading scale, Fontaine. Fontaine wasn't sure, but he thought that might be the National Association of Animatronic Doll Collectors.
Elliot, you know I don't know how to rate condition on these things. They've got all their fingers and toes, right? I mean, the fucking things look alive, okay?
Fontaine heard Elliot sigh. He'd never met the man.
My client, said Elliot, speaking slowly for stress, is a condition queen. He wants them minty. He wants them mintier than minty. He wants them mint in box. He wants them new old stock.
Hey, look, Fontaine said, remembering what Clarice had said.
You don't get these things unused, right? The grandparents bought them as, like, surrogate offspring, right? They were big-ticket items. They got used.
Not always, said Elliot. The most desirable pieces, and my client owns several, are replicas ordered just prior to the unexpected death of the grandchild. Fontaine took the phone from his ear, looking at it as though it were something dirty.
Fucking hell,
Fontaine said under his breath. What's that? Elliot said. What?
Sorry, Elliot, Fontaine said, putting the phone back to his ear. Gotta take one on the other line. I'll get back to you.
Fontaine broke the connection. He was perched on a tall stool behind the counter. He leaned sideways to look at the another one dolls in their bag. They looked horrible. They were horrible. Elliot was horrible. Clarice was horrible, too. But now Fontaine lapsed into a brief but intensely erotic fantasy involving none other, with whom he had not been conjugal in some while. That this fantasy literally involved Clarice exclusively, he took to be significant. That it produced an actual erectile response, he took to be even more significant. He sighed, adjusted his trousers. Life, he reflected, was rough as a cob. through the sound of rain sluicing down around his shop. He'd rigged gutters. He could hear a faint but rapid clicking from the back room and noted its peculiar regularity. Each one of those clicks, he knew, represented another watch. He'd shown the boy how to call up auctions on the notebook, not Christie's or Antique Quorum, but the living messy scrum of the net auctions. He'd shown him how to bookmark, too, because he thought that picking what he liked might be fun. Fontaine sighed again, this time because he had no idea what he would do about the boy. Having taken him in because he'd wanted a closer look at, well, had wanted, did want, the Jaeger-LeCoultre military, Fontaine would have found it impossible to explain to anyone why he had subsequently fed him, gotten him showered, bought him fresh clothes, and shown him how to use the iPhones. Actually, he couldn't explain it to himself. He was not inclined to charity, he didn't think, but sometimes he found himself moving as if to right a particular wrong in the world. And this never made sense to Fontaine, really, because what he made right only for a little while, and nothing ever really changed. This boy now, he very likely had some sort of brain damage, and most likely congenital. But Fontaine believed that trouble had no first cause. There was sheer bad luck, he knew that, but often as not he'd seen how cruelty or neglect or hard luck genetics came twining up through the generations like a vine. Now he dug down deep into the pocket of his tweed slacks where he was keeping the Jaeger-LeCoultre. By itself, of course, so that nothing else would scratch it. He pulled it out now and considered it. But the tenor of his thoughts prevented the momentary distraction, the small pleasure he'd hoped to take from it. But how on earth, he wondered, had the boy gotten hold of something like this, such an elegant piece of serious collector's ordnance? And the workmanship of the strap worried him. He'd never seen anything quite like it, for all that it was very simple. An artisan had sat down with the watch whose lugs were closed not by spring bars, but permanently soldered rods of stainless steel, integral parts of the case, and cut and glued and hand-stitched however many pieces of black calf leather. He examined the inside of the strap, but there was nothing, no trademark or signature. "If you could talk," Fontaine said, looking at the watch. And what would it tell him, he wondered. The story of how the boy had gotten it might turn out to be not the most unlikely adventure it had had. Briefly, he imagined it on some officer's wrist out in the Burmese night, a star shell bursting above a jungle hillside, monkeys screaming. Did they have monkeys in Burma? He did know the British had fought there when this had been issued. He looked down through the scratched greenish glass that topped the counter. Watches there, each face to him a tiny and contained poem, a pocket museum, subject over time to laws of entropy and of chance. These tiny mechanisms, their jeweled hearts beating, wearing down, he knew, through the friction of metal on metal. He sold nothing unserviced, everything cleaned and lubricated. He took fresh stock to a sullen but highly skilled pole in Oakland to be cleaned, oiled, and timed. And he did this, he knew, not to provide a better, more reliable product, but to ensure that each one might better survive in an essentially hostile universe. It would have been difficult to admit this to anyone, but it was true, and he knew it. He put the Jaeger-LeCoultre back in his pocket and slid from the stool, stood staring blankly into a glass-fronted cabinet, the shelf at eye level displaying military dinky toys and a Randall Model 15 Airman, a stocky-looking combat knife with a saw-toothed spine and black micarta grips. The dinky toys had been played with. Dull gray base metal showed through chipped green paint. The Randall was mint, unused, unsharpened, its stainless steel blade exactly as it left the grinding belt. Fontaine wondered how many such had in fact never been used. Totemic objects, they lost considerable resale value if sharpened, and it was his impression that they circulated almost as a species of ritual currency, quite exclusively masculine. He had two currently in stock, the other a hiltless little leaf-point dirk said to have been designed for the U.S. Secret Service. Best dated by the name of the maker on their saddle-sewn sheaths, he estimated them both to be about 30 years old. Such things were devoid of much poetry for Fontaine, although he understood the market and how to value a piece. They spoke to him mainly, as did the window of an army surplus store, of male fear and powerlessness. He turned away now, seeing the dying eyes of a man he'd shot in Cleveland, possibly in the year one of those knives had been made. He locked the door, put the closed sign up, and went into the back room, where he found the boy still seated cross-legged as he'd left him, his face hidden by the massive old iPhones cabled to the open notebook in his lap.
"Hey," Fontaine said, "how's fishing? You been finding anything you think we should bid on?"
The boy continued to monotonously click a single key on the notebook, the iPhones bobbing slightly in time.
"Hey," Fontaine said, "you gonna get net burned."
He squatted beside the boy, wincing at the pain it brought to his knees. He rapped once on the gray cowl of the iPhones, then gently removed them. The boy's eyes blinked furiously, swimming in the vanished light of the miniature video screens. His hand clicked the notebook a few times, then stopped.
"Let's see what you found,"
Fontaine said, taking the notebook from him. He absently touched a few keys, curious to see what the boy might have bookmarked. He was expecting auction pages, each one with a scan and description of a given watch on offer. But what he found instead were numbered lists of articles that came up in an archaic font meant to recall typewriters. He studied one list, then another. He felt something like cold air across the back of his neck and thought for a second that the front door was open, but then he remembered locking it.
"Shit," Fontaine said, pulling up more of these lists. "Shit! How'd you get this?"
These were bank records, confidential tallies of the contents of safety deposit boxes in banks of the brick-and-mortar sort, all apparently in Midwestern states. And each list he saw contained at least one watch, very likely part of someone's estate, and very likely forgotten. A Rolex Explorer in Kansas City. Some sort of gold Patek in a small town in Kansas. He looked from the screen to the boy, aware of being privy to something profoundly anomalous.
"How'd you get into these files?" he asked. "This stuff is private. Should be impossible. Is impossible. How'd you do it?"
And only that absence behind the brown eyes staring back at him, either infinitely deep or of no depth at all, he couldn't tell. 31. View from a Hellwood Stanchion. He dreams of a vast elevator descending, its floor like the ballroom of some ancient liner. Its sides are open, in part, and he finds her there at the rail, beside an ornate cast-iron stanchion worked in cherubs and bunches of grapes, their outlines softened beneath innumerable coats of a black enamel glossy as wet ink. Beyond the black stanchion and the aching geometry of her profile, a darkened world spreads to every horizon, island continents blacker than the seas in which they swim, the lights of great yet nameless cities reduced to firefly glimmers at this height, this distance. The elevator, this ballroom, this waltzing host unseen now but sensed as background, as necessary gestalt, descends, it seems, down all his days, in some coded iteration of the history that brings him to this night. If it is night. The knife's plain haft against his ribs through a starched evening shirt. The handles of a craftsman's tools bespeak an absolute simplicity, the plainest forms affording the greatest range of possibilities for the user's hand. That which is over-designed, too highly specific, anticipates outcome. The anticipation of outcome guarantees, if not failure, the absence of grace. And now she turns to him, and she is, in that instant, all she ever was to him, and something more. For he is aware in that same instant that this is a dream, this mighty cage descending, and she is lost as ever. And now he opens his eyes to the gray and perfectly neutral ceiling,
of the bedroom on Russian Hill. He lies dead straight, atop the blanket of gray lamb's wool made up in military fashion, in his gray flannel shirt with its platinum links, his black trousers, his black wool socks. His hands are folded on his chest like the hands of a medieval effigy, a knight atop his own sarcophagus, and the telephone is ringing. He touches one of the platinum cufflinks to answer.
"It isn't too late, I hope," says the voice.
"For what?" he asks, unmoving.
"I needed to talk."
"Do you?"
"More so lately."
"And why is that?"
"The time draws near."
"The time?" And he sees again the view from the huge cage descending.
"Can't you feel it? You with your right place at the right time, you with your letting things unfold, can't you feel it?"
"I do not deal in outcomes."
"But you do," the voice says. "You've dealt a few for me, after all. You become an outcome."
"No," the man says. "I simply discover that place where I am supposed to be."
"You make it sound so simple. I wish that it were that simple for me."
"It could be," the man says. "But you are addicted to complexity."
"More literally than you know," says the voice,
and the man imagines the few square inches of satellite circuitry through which it comes to him. That tiniest and most costly of principalities. "It's all about complexity now. It is about your will in the world," the man says and raises his arms, cupping the back of his head in his hands. There follows a silence.
"There was a time," the voice says at last, "when I believed that you were playing a game with me, that all of that was something you made up for me, to annoy me, or amuse me, to hold my interest, to ensure my patronage."
"I have never been in need of your patronage," the man says mildly.
"No, I suppose not," the voice continues. "There will always be those who need certain others not to be, and will pay to make it so. But it's true. I took you to be another mercenary, one with an expressed philosophy, perhaps, but I took that philosophy to be nothing more than a way you had discovered of making yourself interesting, of setting yourself apart from the pack."
"Where I am," the man says to the gray neutral ceiling, "there is no pack."
"Oh, there's a pack. All right. Bright young things guaranteeing executive outcomes. Brochures. They have brochures. And lines to read between. What were you doing when I called?"
"Dreaming," the man says.
"I wouldn't have imagined somehow that you dream. Was it a good dream?"
The man considers the perfect blankness of the gray ceiling. Remembered geometry of facial bone threatens to form there. He closes his eyes.
"I was dreaming of hell," he says. "How was it?"
"An elevator descending."
"Christ," says the voice, "this poetry is unlike you."
Another silence follows. The man sits up. Feels the smooth, dark, polished wood cool through his black socks. He begins to perform a series of very specific exercises that involve a minimum of visible movement. There is stiffness in his shoulders. At some distance he hears a car go past, tires on wet pavement.
"I'm not very far from you at the moment," the man says, breaking the silence. "I'm in San Francisco."
Now it is the man's turn for silence. He continues his exercises, remembering the Cuban beach decades ago, on which he was first taught this sequence and its variations. His teacher that day, the master of a school of Argentine knife fighting, most authoritatively declared non-existent by responsible scholars of the martial arts.
"How long has it been?" the voice asks, since we've spoken face to face?
Some years, says the man.
I think I need to see you now. Something extraordinary is on the verge of happening.
Really, says the man, and no one sees his brief and wolfish smile. Are you about to become contented?
A laugh beamed down from the secret streets of that sub-miniature cityscape in geosynchronous orbit. Not that extraordinary, no. But some very basic state is on the brink of change, and we are near its locus.
We? We have no current involvement.
Physically, geographically, it's happening here.
The man moves into the final sequence of the exercise, remembering flies on the instructor's face during that initial demonstration.
Why did you go to the bridge last night?
I needed to think, the man says, and stands.
Nothing drew you there?
Memory, loss, flesh ghost in Market Street, the smell of cigarettes in her hair, her winter lips chilled against his, opening into warmth.
Nothing, he says, hands closing on nothing.
It's time for us to meet, the voice says. Hands opening, releasing nothing.
32. Lower companions. The back of the van collected a quarter inch of water before the rain quit.
Cardboard,
Chivette told Tessa.
Cardboard?
We'll find some dry boxes. Open them out, put down a couple of layers. Be dry enough. Tessa clicked her flashlight on and had another look.
We're going to sleep in that puddle?
It's interstitial, Chivette told her. Tessa turned the light off, swung around.
Look, she said, pointing with the flashlight. At least it isn't pissing down now. Let's go back to the bridge. Find a pub. Something to eat. We'll worry about this later.
Chivette said that would be fine, just as long as Tessa didn't bring God's little toy, or in any other way record the rest of the evening. And Tessa agreed to that. They left the van parked there and walked back along the Embarcadero, past razor wire and barricades that sealed, ineffectually, Chivette knew, the ruined piers. There were dealers in the shadows there, and before they'd gotten to the bridge, they were offered speed, plug, weed, opium, and dancer. Chivette explained that these dealers weren't sufficiently competitive to take and hold positions farther along, nearer the bridge. Those were the coveted spots, and the dealers along the Embarcadero were either moving toward or away from that particular arena.
How do they compete? Tessa asked. Do they fight?
No, said Chivette. It's the market, right? The ones with good shit, good prices, and they turn up. Well, the users want to see them. Somebody came with bad shit, bad prices, the users drive them off. But you can see them change when you live here. See them every day. Most of that stuff, if they're using themselves, it'll take them down. Wind up back down here, then you just don't see them.
They don't settle on the bridge?
Well, Chivette said, yeah, they do, but not so much. And when they do, they're quieter about it. You don't get offered on the bridge so much, not if they don't know you.
So how is it like that? Tessa asked. How do people know not to? Where does the rule come from?
Chivette thought about it. It isn't a rule, she said. It's just you aren't supposed to do it. Then she laughed. I don't know. It's just like that. Like there aren't too many fights, but the ones there are tend to be serious and people get hurt.
How many people actually live out here?
Tessa asked as they walked up the ramp from Bryant.
I don't know, Chivette said. I'm not sure anyone does. Used to be everyone who did anything here, who had a business going, they lived here, because you have to be in possession. No rent or anything. Now, though, you get businesses that are run like businesses, you know? That bad sector we were in. Somebody owns all that stock. They built that storefront. And I bet they pay that sumo boy to sleep in the back. Hold it down for them.
But you didn't work here when you lived here?
Nah, Chivette said.
I was messing as soon as I could. Got myself a bike and I was all over town.
They made their way into the lower level, past boxes of fish on ice, until they came to a place Chevette remembered on the south side. It had food sometimes, sometimes music, and it had no name.
They do good hot wings in here, Chevette said.
You like hot wings?
I'll let you know after I've had a beer.
Tessa was looking around at the place, like she was trying to decide how interstitial it was. It turned out they had an Australian beer Tessa really liked, called a Redback, came in a brown bottle with a red spider on it, and Tessa explained that these spiders were the Australian equivalent of a black widow. Maybe worse. It was a good beer, though. Chevette had to agree. And after they both had one, and ordered another. Tessa ordered a cheeseburger, and Chevette ordered a plate of hot wings and a side of fries. This place really smelled like a bar. Stale beer, smoke, fry grease, sweat. She remembered the first bars she'd ever gone into, places along rural highways back up in Oregon. And they'd smelled like this. The bars Carson had taken her to in L.A. hadn't smelled like anything much. Like aromatherapy candles, sort of. There was a stage down at one end, just a low black platform raised about a foot above the floor, and there were musicians there setting up, plugging things in. There was some kind of keyboard, drums, a mic stand. Chevette had never been that much into music, not any particular kind, although in her messenger days she'd gotten to like dancing in clubs in San Francisco. Carson, though, he'd been very particular about what music he liked. And had tried to teach Chevette to appreciate it like he did. But she just hadn't gotten with it at all. He was into this 20th century stuff, a lot of it French, particularly this Serge something, really creepy ass. Sounded like the guy was being slowly jerked off while he sang, but like it really wasn't even doing that much for him. She'd bought this new chrome Koran, My War is My War, sort of out of self-defense. But she hadn't even liked it that much herself. And the one time she'd put it on, when Carson was there, he'd looked at her like she'd shit on his broadloom or something. These guys now setting up on their little stage, they weren't bridge people, but she knew that they were musicians, some of them famous, who'd come out and record on the bridge just so they could say they had. There was a big man up there with a white, stubbly face and a sort of mashed-up cowboy hat on the back of his head. He was fiddling with an unplugged guitar. And listening to a smaller man in jeans wearing a belt buckle like an engraved silver dinner platter. Hey, Chevette said, indicating the bottle blonde man with the belt buckle. This girl gets molested in the dark, tells him it was a meshback, did it? Well, they say, how do you know if it was dark? Because he had a tiny little dick and a great big belt buckle.
What's a meshback?
Tessa tilted back the last of her beer. Rednecks, Skinner called them. Chevette said. It's from those nylon baseball caps they used to wear. Got black nylon mesh on the back for ventilation. My mother used to call them gimme hats.
Why?
Tessa asked her. Gimme one of them hats. Give them away free with advertising on them.
Country music, that sort of thing?
Well, more like Dukes of Nukem and stuff. I don't think that's country music.
It's the music of a disenfranchised, mostly white proletariat.
Tessa said.
Barely hanging on in post-industrial America. Or that's what they'd say on Real One. But we have that joke about the big buckles in Australia, except it's about pilots and wristwatches.
Chevette thought the man with the belt buckle was staring back at her, so she looked in the other direction, at the crowd around the pool table. And here there actually were a couple of mesh-backed hats, so she pointed these out to Tessa by way of illustration.
Excuse me, ladies,
someone said, a woman. And Chevette turned to face directly into the line of fire of some very serious bosom laced up into a shiny black top. Huge cloud of blousy blonde hair a la Ashley Modine Carter, who Chevette thought of as a singer meshbacks would listen to if they listened to women, which she wasn't certain they did. The woman put two freshly opened redbacks down on their table.
With Mr. Creedmore's compliments, she said, beaming at them. Mr. Creedmore?
Tessa asked.
Buell Creedmore, honey, the woman said. That's him over there getting ready to do the sound check with the legendary Randy Schoetz.
Is he a musician?
He's a singer, honey, the woman said, and seemed to look more closely at Tessa. You A&R?
No, Chevette said.
Damn, the woman said, and Chevette thought for a second she might take the beers back. I thought you might be from an alternative label.
Alternative to what?
Tessa asked. The woman brightened. Buell singing, honey.
It isn't like what you probably think of as country. Well, actually, it's a roots thing. Buell wants to take it back there past Waylon and Willie, to some kind of dark, primal kind of heartland kind of thing.
The woman beamed, eyes slightly unfocused. Chevette got the feeling that all of that had been memorized, and maybe not too well, but that it was her job to get it out.
Randy, he was teaching Buell one earlier, called There Was Whiskey and Blood on the Highway, But I Didn't Hear Nobody Pray. That's a hymn, honey. Very traditional. Give me goosebumps to hear it. I think it's called that anyway, but tonight's set is going to be more upbeat, electric.
Cheers,
Tessa said.
Ta for the lager.
The woman looked puzzled.
Oh, you're welcome, honey. Please do stick around for the set. It's Buell's Northern California debut, and the first time he's actually sung with his lower companions.
His what? Chevette asked.
Buell Creedmoor and his lower companions. I think it's a biblical reference, though I can't quote you chapter and verse.
The woman pointed her straining bosom toward the stage and resolutely followed it in that direction. Chevette didn't really want another beer. She bought us these because she thought we were A&R. She knew about that because of Carson. A&R were the people in the music business who found and developed talent. Tessa took a pull on her beer and watched the woman, who'd stopped to talk to one of the boys from the pool table, one of the ones who was actually wearing a mesh-backed cap.
Do people like I'd live here?
No,
Chevette said. There's clubs in the city for this kind of thing, or sort of like it, but I've never seen a crowd like this out here before. The sound check consisted of the man with the squashed cowboy hat playing guitar and the man with the belt buckle singing. They stopped and started a few times, on the one song they did, for various twiddlings of knobs, but the guitarist could really play. Chevette got the feeling he wasn't really letting it out yet, what he could do. And the singer could sing. It was a song about being sad and being tired of being sad. The bar, meanwhile, was starting to fill up with what looked to be a bunch of locals, regulars, and a bunch who weren't, who were here to hear the band. The locals tended to tattoos, facial piercings, and asymmetrical haircuts, while the visitors tended to hats, meshback and cowboy mostly, jeans, and, on the men anyway, guts. The guts tended to be the kind that looked as though they had moved in while their owners were unaware and had taken up residence on otherwise fat-free frames. The kind of gut that hangs over the top of a pair of jeans with a reasonably small waistband, swelling the front of a flannel shirt, but cinched back in below with one of those big buckles. She'd started on Creedmoor's red back out of boredom, when she spotted the singer himself headed their way. He had borrowed someone's mesh-backed cap and pulled it on backward over his weirdly wet-looking bleach-blonde hair. He was wearing an electric blue cowboy shirt with the store creases still in it, horizontal across the chest, and the white pearlized snaps open halfway down the front, revealing a pale, white, decidedly concave chest that wasn't at all the color of his face, which she figured was painted on. He had what looked like tomato juice in each hand, in a tall glass, with ice.
"How do?" he said. "Saw that Mary Alice over here, thought I'd bring the old girl a drink. I'm Buell Creedmoor. You ladies enjoying your beer?"
"Yes, thanks," said Tessa, and looked in the opposite direction.
Creedmoor did a quick, and to Chevette very obvious, piece of mental calculation, Chevette coming up as the one more likely to be profitably hit on.
"You hear about us in the city here, or over in Oakland?"
"We're just here for the hot wings," Chevette said, indicating the plate of chicken bones in front of her.
"They any good?"
"They're okay," Chevette said, "but we're just leaving."
"Leaving?"
Creedmoor took a big swig of his tomato juice.
"Hell, we're on in 10. You ought to stay and hear us."
There was some weird-looking, greenish, sandy stuff, Chevette saw, around the rims of the glasses, and now some of this was stuck on Creedmoor's upper lip. "What are you doing with those Caesars, Buell?" It was the big guitarist. "Now, you promised me you wouldn't drink before the set."
"For Mary Alice," Creedmoor said, gesturing with a glass. "And this here's for the pretty lady."
He put the one he'd had the swig from down in front of Chevette. "So how come you got that garlic salt on your mouth?" the big man asked. Creedmoor grinned and wiped the back of his hand across his mouth.
"Nerves, Randy. Big night. Gonna be okay."
"It better be, Buell. I don't see some evidence you can hold your liquor. Be the last gig you ever play with me." The guitarist took the drink out of Creedmoor's hand, took a sip, made a face, and walked off taking the drink with him.
"Sons of bitches,"
Creedmoor said. And it was at this point that Chevette saw Carson enter the bar. Recognition on her part was instantaneous and 100% positive. It was not Carson as dressed for lounges that smelled like aromatherapy, but Carson dressed for the knowing exploration of the lower reaches. Chevette had actually been with him when he bought this outfit, so she'd had to hear about how the jacket was Alaskan steer hide, Alaskan steers having thicker hides due to the cold winters, and a museum-grade reproduction of a 1940s original. The jeans were nearly as expensive, and more complicated in their sourcing. The denim woven in Japan on ancient, lovingly maintained American looms, and then finished in Tunisia to the specifications of a team of Dutch designers and garment historians. This was the kind of stuff that Carson cared deeply about, this absolutely authentic fake stuff, and when Chevette saw him step through that entrance, she had absolutely no doubt that it was him. And also, though she couldn't have said exactly how, she knew that she was in trouble. Maybe, she'd think later, it had been because he hadn't known she was looking, so he hadn't really been bothering to be the guy he had always pretended to be when he was with her, when he'd known she was looking. It was like seeing a different guy, a very scary, very cold, very angry guy, and knowing it was Carson. Carson turning to scan the bar. What she did next surprised her. It must have surprised Creedmoor even more. The top of the huge silver buckle made a convenient handle. She grabbed it, pulled, and brought him down, loose-kneed, to kiss his mouth, throwing her arms around his neck and hoping the back of his head, in the backward mesh-back hat, was between her face and Carson's. Creedmoor's ready enthusiasm was unfortunately about what she'd have expected, had she had the time to think. 33. Durius. Rydell was midway back through the lower-level crunch when his sunglasses rang. He got his back to the nearest wall, took them out, opened them, put them on. "Rydell?"
"Yeah?"
"Durius, man, how are you?"
"Fine,"
Rydell said. The glasses were acting up. Weirdly elongated segments of Rio street maps were scrolling down his field of vision.
"How are you?"
He heard the whine of a drill or power driver somewhere in L.A.
"You at the Dragon?"
"Yeah," Durius said. "We got major construction underway here."
"What for?"
"Don't know," Durius said. "They're putting in a new node back by the ATM. Where they had the baby food and child care products before, you know. Park won't say what it is. Don't think he knows. All the branches getting them, whatever they are. How's your ride up? How's that Creedmoor?"
"I think he's an alcoholic, Durius."
"No shit," Durius said. "How's the new job?"
"Well," Rydell said, "I don't think I figured out much about it yet, but it's getting interesting."
"That's good," Durius said. "Well, just wanted to see how you're doing. Praise God, she says hi. Wants to know if you like the glasses." The Rio street map shuddered, contracted, stretched again.
"Tell her they're great," Rydell said. "Tell her thanks."
"Will do," said Durius. "You take care."
"You too," Rydell said,
the maps vanishing as Durius hung up.
Rydell removed the glasses and put them away. Beef bowl. Maybe he could grab some ghetto chef beef bowl on the way back. Then he thought about Klaus and the rooster and decided he'd better check on the thermos first.
34. Market discontinuities.
"What's this look like to you, Marshal?"
Fontaine asked his lawyer, Marshal Matitze of Matitze Rapedego Nyembo, whose premises consisted of three notebooks and an antique Chinese bicycle. Marshall made tooth-sucking noises on the other end of the line, and Fontaine knew he was looking at the lists the boy had pulled up.
"They seem to be lists of the contents of safety deposit boxes, as required under state law in various jurisdictions. Anti-terrorist legislation keeps people from stashing drug precursors, nuclear warheads, like that. Plus, it was supposed to help prevent money laundering, but that was when money could still be big stacks of green paper. But if I were you, Fontaine, I would be asking my lawyer a different question, to wit, am I not breaking the law by being in possession of these documents?"
"Am I?" Fontaine asked. Marshall maintained telephone silence for a few seconds.
"Yes," he said, "you are. But it depends on how you got them, and I have just determined that the actual owners of the listed properties in every case are dead."
"Dead?"
"Entirely. These are probate documents, still protected by law. But I would say that some items on these lists are property to be auctioned off as the various estates are executed."
Fontaine looked over his shoulder and saw the boy still seated on the floor, down his third iced guava smoothie.
"How did you get these?" Marshall asked.
"I'm not sure," Fontaine said.
"You aren't supposed to be able to decrypt files like this," Marshall said, "not unless you're the Fed. If someone else does the decryption, it's merely a privacy issue insofar as you're concerned. But if you're doing this yourself or are knowingly party to it, you are in possession of or are party to possession of proscribed technology, which can earn you a stay in one of those extremely efficient prisons the private sector has done such a fine job of building and maintaining."
"I'm not," said Fontaine.
"Be that as it may," said Marshall. "If you were, you might be able, through judicious application, and with all due secrecy, to use said technology to reveal certain lucrative market discontinuities. Follow me, Fontaine?"
"No,"
said Fontaine. "Put it this way. If you have a way of getting hold of documents nobody else can, you might want to talk about it with someone who'd have an idea of exactly which documents might be most lucratively obtained."
"Hey, Marshall, I'm not into—"
"Fontaine, please. Anyone who sells secondhand cutlery and old rat-sucked toys, I understand it's an avocation, a calling. You are not in it for the money, I know. However, if you have a back channel into something else, I advise you to consult with your lawyer, me, at your very earliest. Hear me?"
"Marshall, I don't—"
"Clarice has been making inquiries of another partner in our firm, Fontaine. I tell you that in confidence." Fontaine was not happy to hear it. "She is talking divorce, my friend."
"Gotta go, Marshall. Customers."
Fontaine hung up. Marshall's news about Clarice was not all that new to Fontaine, but he had been so far successful in avoiding thinking about it. He became aware of a soft, steady clicking and turned to see that the boy had put the iPhones back on. 35. On automatic. Chevette hadn't closed her eyes when she'd pulled Creedmoor down and kissed him. But with her arms locked around his neck to hold him there and hide her from Carson, she couldn't see past the sleeve of Skinner's jacket. What she could see, past an out-of-focus view of Creedmoor's cheekbone and left ear, was an adrenaline-sharp shot of Carson's progress through the crowd. This was sufficiently arresting that she had managed to ignore Creedmoor's response, which had his tongue trying apparently to subdue hers, with a so far unsuccessful combination of speed and leverage, and his hands up under Skinner's jacket, hunting frantically for nipple. The crystal-clear shot of Carson was eclipsed by a close-up of Tessa, eyes wide with amazement and about to burst out laughing, just as Creedmore found one of the nipples he was after, and Chevette, in pure reflex, let go of his neck with her left arm and punched him as hard and discreetly as possible in the ribs, going in with all the knuckles she could leverage. Creedmore's eyes flew open, blue and bloodshot, and Chevette let go of him, ducked off her chair, and rolled under the table, all on automatic now. She thought she heard Creedmore's head hit the table as he tried to follow her, but now that he didn't have his mouth actually on hers, she was aware of the taste of it, and something naggingly familiar there. But that was just something her mind was doing while her body took her out of there the quickest way it saw, which was a scramble on hands and knees, still under the table, out on the floor, still crouching, but getting up speed, sprinting, still bent low, arms up to block anyone who might try to stop her, out through the door. Where instinct, something, some recollection, took her right, toward Oakland. And she didn't slow down until she felt it was safe to, but by then she'd realized what the taste in Creedmore's mouth was. Dancer. And she wondered how much of that she'd taken on. Not much, probably. But she could feel it in the pounding of her heart, see it in a faint aura around every source of light now, and know it in the fact that none of what had just happened actually bothered her very much. Trouble could look abstract on Dancer. Carson, she thought, was trouble, and seeing the look on his face then, a look she'd suspected, she now thought, but had never quite managed to catch there, had made her scared of him. She'd been scared of him since the time he'd hit her, but she hadn't understood it in quite the same way. He hadn't really hurt her much, not physically, when he'd hit her. She was coming from a place where she'd seen people maimed, hurt really bad, and this cute media boy who didn't even know how to punch. How dangerous was that? But now she saw, the residual drug in Creedmore's saliva having its effect, that what she'd been afraid of wasn't that he'd hit her that time, or the possibility he'd do it again, but some instinctive, underlying recognition that there was something wrong, something way worse, that he was bad news, and covered it up, always more carefully even than he chose his clothes. And Tessa, when Chevette had had the conversation with her that had resulted in her moving to Malibu, had said that she envied men the inability to get it up when there was something wrong. Even if they don't consciously know, Tessa said, it won't happen. But we don't have that, so something can be just as wrong as can be, and we still stay. But you can't stay if he's hit you, because he'll do it again. Walking on toward Treasure now, the bridge gone spectral, monochrome. And maybe that was the Dancer, too. She didn't know. Out of control, she said. That was how she felt her life was now. She was just reacting to things. She stopped. Maybe she was just reacting to Carson. Hey, Chevette! Turning to see a face she knew, though she couldn't put a name to it. Ragged pale hair above a thin, hard face, bad scar snaking his left cheek. A sometime messenger from her allied days, not part of her crew, but a face from parties. Heron, the name came to her. I thought you were gone, Heron said, displaying broken teeth. Maybe something broken in his head, too, it struck her. Or maybe just some substance, tonight. I was, Chevette said. Where? SoCal. You ride down there, messenger? No, she said. I can't ride now, Heron said, and swung his left leg rigid forward, catching his weight on it. Something wrong there with his knee. Tangled with a cage. A car. And she thought about how long it had been since she'd heard that. You get insurance? Shit, no. Cage from Dodge City. The Department of Justice. I got lawyers on it, but... Crooked shrug. One of my lawyers, Nyembo. You know those three guys? Refugees from the African Union, right? Nyembo. He knows that Fontaine. You know Fontaine, right? Yeah, Chevette said, glancing back over her shoulder. He's still out by Oakland, wives and kids? No, Heron said. No, he's got a shop. Just up there. He pointed.
sleeps there. Sells stuff to tourists. Nyembo says his wives are after his ass.
He squinted at her, the scar on his cheek catching the light.
You look good. Hair's different.
Something in that flash of scar catching in the edge of Creedmoor's spit-high, she shivered. The dancer dealing her cards of Carson walking this way, that same expression on his face, hands in the pockets of his leather jacket.
Good to see you, Heron.
Yeah, he said.
Something sullen and untrusting, maybe longing, evident there. And again the crooked shrug, maybe just to shake some pain from his shoulders. He looked down and set off back the way she'd come. And she saw how twisted the accident had left him, hobbling, swinging his stiff leg as he went. She zipped up Skinner's jacket and went looking for Fontaine's shop, wondering if she'd know it if she found it. 36. Famous Aspect. Rydell bought a white foam takeout beef bowl from Ghetto Chef, then had to figure out how to get up the ladder one-handed without spilling it. Climbing a ladder with something hot in one hand was one of those things that you never ordinarily thought about, but that turned out to be difficult. You can't safely tuck a hot beef bowl under your arm, and when you climb with only one hand, you've got to move that hand fast, keep catching those rungs. But he got up there, didn't spill any, and then he put it down while he unlocked the 2x4 and chicken wire security grid. This had a chrome-plated Nepalese padlock on either side, and he'd found the keys earlier hanging on a nail. It was one of those deeply pointless arrangements in terms of security, because anyone who wanted in could bolt-cut the padlocks, pry their hasps out of the wood, or just yank the chicken wire until the staples pulled out. On the other hand, if you went out, left it unlocked, and somebody took your stuff with no effort at all, he guessed you'd feel even stupider. When he got it open, he settled down on the foot of the bed with his beef bowl and the plastic spoon they'd given him. He was just inhaling the steam when it came to him he should check on the thermos thing, the projector, Laney had called it. He sighed, put his beef bowl down, and got up. Well, he had to crouch. The Globex box was in the cabinet there beside his bag, and the spun metal cylinder was in the Globex box. He sat back down with the Globex box next to him on the bed and got to work on his beef bowl, which was worth waiting for. It was strange how this kind of shaved, basically overcooked mystery meat, which he guessed really was probably beef, could be tastier, under the right circumstances, than a really good steak. He ate the whole thing, every last grain of rice and drop of broth, and figured the tourist trap map had put their 3.5 stars in the right place. Then he opened the Globex box and got the thermos thing out. He looked at the famous Aspect sticker again, and it didn't tell him any more than it had before. He stood the thing up on its base, on the green and orange carpet, and crawled back up the bed to get the switchblade. He used that to slice open the plastic envelopes containing the two cables and sat there looking at them. The one that was standard power just looked like what you used to run a notebook off the wall, he thought, although the end that went into the thermos looked a little more complicated than usual. The other one, though, the jacks on either end looked serious. He found the socket that one end of this obviously went into, but what was the other end supposed to fit? If the sumo kid was telling the truth, this was a custom cable, required to jack this thing into something that it might not usually be required to jack to. This one was optical, it looked like. The power cable, that was easy. What took a while was finding a socket up here, but it turned out there was one, well, actually the end of an industrial gray yellow extension cord, in the storage cabinet. No control on the thing that he could see, no switches. He plugged the power cable into the wall socket, then sat on the bed, the other end in his hand, looking at the silvery cylinder. "Hail," he said, and plugged the cable into the cylinder. Just as he did, he had the clearest possible vision of the thing being absolutely and no doubt brimful of plastic explosive and a detonator just waiting for this juice. But no, if it had been, he'd be dead. He wasn't. But the cylinder wasn't doing anything either. He thought he could hear a faint hum from it, and that was it. "I don't get it," Rydell said.
Something flickered. Neon butterfly. Torn wings. And then this girl was there, kneeling, right up close. And he felt his heart roll over, catch itself. The how of her not being there, then being there. Something hurt in his chest, until he reminded himself to breathe. If Rydell had had to describe her, he would have said beautiful, and been utterly frustrated in the attempt to convey how. He thought she had to be one of Durius's examples of hybrid vigor, but saying which races had been mixed was beyond him. "Where are we?" she asked. He blinked, uncertain as to whether she saw and addressed him or someone else in some other reality. "Bed and breakfast," he said, by way of experiment. "San Francisco, Oakland Bay." "You are Laney's friend?"
Well, yeah.
She was looking around now with evident interest, and Rydell felt the hairs stand up along his arms, seeing that she wore an outfit that exactly mirrored his own, though everything she wore fit her perfectly, and of course looked very different on her. Loose khakis, blue work shirt, black nylon jacket with a Velcro rectangle over the heart, where you stuck the logo of your company, right down to black socks. With holes, he wondered, and miniature versions of the black working walks he'd bought for Lucky Dragon. But the hair on his arms was up because he knew. He had seen, he had, that in the first instant of her being there, she'd crouched before him, naked. "I am Ray Thoy," she said. Her hair was coarse and glossy and roughly but perfectly cut, her mouth wide and generous, and not quite smiling, and Rydell put out his hand and watched it pass right through her shoulder. Through the pattern of coherent light, he knew she must be. "This is a hologram," she said, "but I am real." "Where are you?" Rydell asked, withdrawing his hand. "I'm here," she said. "But where are you really?"
"Here.
This is not a broadcast hologram. It is generated by the famous aspect unit. I am here with you. Your room is very small. Are you poor?" She crawled past Rydell. He supposed she could have crawled through him if he hadn't moved aside, to the head of his bed, examining the salt-caked hemisphere of plastic. Rydell could see now that she literally was a source of illumination, though somehow it reminded him of moonlight. "It's a rented room," Rydell said, "and I'm not rich." She looked back at this.
"I meant no offense."
"That's okay," Rydell said, looking from her to the projector and back. "I mean, a lot of people, they'd think I'm poor."
"But more would think you rich."
"I don't know about that."
"I do," she said. "There are literally more humans alive at this moment who have measurably less than you do. You have this sleeping place. You have clothing. I see you have eaten. What is your name?"
"Barry Rydell," he said, feeling a strange shyness. But he thought he at least knew who she was, or was supposed to be.
"Look, I recognize you. You're that Japanese singer, the one who isn't... I mean, the one who doesn't exist?"
"I didn't say that. I mean, weren't you supposed to be married to that Irish guy, Chinese, whatever, in that band?"
"Yes."
She'd stretched out on the bed on her stomach, hands propping her chin a few inches from the occluded plastic bubble. Rydell had a flash of that scene from the water below, like the glaucous eye of some behemoth.
"But we did not marry Barry Rydell."
"How do you know Laney?" he asked her, hoping to bring it around to some footing that he could stand on as well, whatever that might be.
"Laney and I are friends, Barry Rydell. Do you know where he is?"
"Not exactly," Rydell said, which was true. She rolled over, gorgeous, and quite literally glowing,
in her incongruous mirroring of what he wore, which looked on her like the first and purest expression of some irresistible new fashion, and fixed him with a sorrowful stare. He would in that moment have happily and willingly locked eyes with her for however long she wanted, and have sat there effectively forever.
Lainey and I have been separated. I do not understand why, but I must trust that it is for our mutual and eventual good. Who gave you the projector, Barry Rydell?
I don't know, Rydell said. It was shipped here, Globex, but in Lainey's name, address in Melbourne, company called Paragon Asia.
She raised her eyebrows. Do you know why we are together in San Francisco, Barry Rydell?
No, he said. Do you?
Lainey believes that the world will end soon, she said,
and her smile was luminous. He couldn't help but smile back. I think we went through that one when the century rolled over.
Lainey says that that was only a date. Lainey says that this is the real thing. But I have not spoken with him in weeks, Barry Rydell. I do not know how much closer we are now to the nodal point.
37. A little ship money. Boomzilla with a little ship money tonight, debit chip he got off those truck bitches, goes down to Lucky Dragon. That's where he goes when he gets money, because they got all the shit. Food he likes there because it's not bridge food. Food like on TV, out of a package. And everything, shit to look at, the games they got in there, best place. Someday he'll have his shit together right. He'll live in a house. And it will be clean as Lucky Dragon, all lit up like that. And he'll get those camera balloons like the truck bitches. Watch everybody's ass and nobody fuck with him. Gets the chip out, walking up to the front. Because if he has it in his hand, shows it to the security, security will let him in. Security wants to know you're a player. Otherwise he'd steal. Boomzilla understands that. Tonight is different. Tonight a big white truck in front of Lucky Dragon. Biggest, cleanest truck he's ever seen. No writing on it, SoCal plates, a couple of security standing out by it. Boomzilla wonders if this what they bring the new games in. Never seen this before. So in the doors, holding up his chip, and heads over like he does first to the candy. Boomzilla likes this Jap candy that's like a little drug lab. You mix these different parts, it fizzes, gets hot, cools. You do this extrusion molding thing and watch it harden. When you eat it, it's just candy. But Boomzilla likes making it. Get six of those, pissed there's no grape, and a couple of two chocos. Spends a good long time by the machine that makes magazines, watching screens, all the different shit you can get put in your magazine. Then back to get his noodles, kind you add water and pull the string. Back there, deciding between beef and chicken, he sees they've unfastened the whole piece of Lucky Dragon wall, next to Globex and the cash machine. So he thinks this is what the white truck is about, some new thing to put in there, and he wonders if it's maybe a game. White men in white paper suits, working on the section of wall. Watches them, then goes back to the front, shows his shit. Checker runs his shit over the window that counts, takes Boomzilla's chip and debits it. There goes his shit money. Takes his bag outside and finds a curb to sit on. Pretty soon he'll start making the first candy, red one. He looks past the white truck to the screens there by the front, and he notices white trucks on half the screens. So all over the world now, those white trucks sitting outside Lucky Dragons. So it must mean something new is being put in all of them tonight. Boomzilla unseals the candy and studies the multi-stage, but entirely non-verbal instructions. Gotta get it right. 38. Vincent Black Lightning. Fontaine's shop must be this narrow purple one, with its high, thin window caulked with enough silicon to frost a wedding cake. The whole front of the place had been painted the same flat purple, blistered now by sun and rain,
and she had some faint memory of its earlier incarnation as something else. Used clothing, maybe. They'd put that purple over everything. Over the droops and gobs of silicone, over the hardware on the old wooden door with its upper panels replaced with glass. If this was Fontaine's place, he hadn't bothered naming it, but that was like him. And the few things displayed in the window, under the beam of an antique tensor, were like him as well. A few old-fashioned watches with their dials going rusty, a bone-handled jackknife someone had polished till it shone, and some kind of huge, ugly telephone sheathed in ridged black rubber. Fontaine was crazy about old things, and sometimes, before, he'd bring different pieces over, show them to Skinner. Sometimes she'd thought he'd just done that to get the old man started, and then Skinner's own stories would come out. He hadn't been much for stories, Skinner, but turning some battered treasure of Fontaine's in his hands, he'd talk, and Fontaine would sit and listen, and nod sometimes, as though Skinner's stories confirmed some long-held suspicion. Made privy to Skinner's past, Fontaine would then handle the objects himself with a new excitement, asking questions. Fontaine lived in the world of things, it had seemed to her, the world of things people made, and probably it was easier for him to approach them, people, through these things. If Skinner couldn't tell Fontaine a story about something, Fontaine would make up his own story, read function in the shape of something, read use in the way it was worn down. It seemed to comfort him. Everything to Fontaine had a story. Each object, each fragment comprising the built world, a chorus of voices, the past alive in everything, that sea upon which the present tossed and rode. When he'd built Skinner's funicular, the elevator that crawled like a small cable car up the angled iron of the tower, when the old man's hip had gotten too bad to allow him to easily climb, Fontaine had had a story about the derivation of each piece. He wove their stories together, applied electricity. The thing rose, clicking, to the hatch in the floor of Skinner's room. Now she stands there, looking into the window, at these watches with their foxed faces, their hands unmoving. And she fears history. Fontaine will fit her to history in some different way she knows, and it is a history she has avoided. Through the thick pane of the door, thick enough to bend light, the way water in a glass does, she sees that the lights are on in a space behind the shop. Another door there, not quite closed. Closed, cerrado, says the dog-eared cardboard sign hung inside the glass on a suction cup shower hook. She knocks. Almost immediately, the inner door is opened, a figure silhouetted there against brightness. Hey, Fontaine! Chevette! It's me! The figure shuffles forward, and she sees that it is in fact him, this angular black man whose graying hair is twisted into irregular branches that hang like the arms of a dusty houseplant in need of water. As he rounds the flat gleam of a glass-topped counter, she sees that he holds a gun, the old-fashioned kind with the cylinder that turns as the bullets are fired manually one at a time. Fontaine? It's me. He stops there, looking, takes a step forward, lowers the pistol. Chevette? Yeah? Hold on! He comes forward and peers at her, past her. You alone? Yes, she says, glancing to either side. Hold on! A rattling of locks, bolts undone, and at last the door opens, and he blinks at her, mystified. You back? How are you, Fontaine? Fine, he says, fine, and steps back. Come in. She does. The place smells of machine oil, metal polish, burnt coffee. A thousand things gleam from the depths of Fontaine's history reef. Thought you were in L.A., he says. I was. I'm back. He closes the door and starts locking it, an elaborate process, but one he can do in the dark, in his sleep, perhaps. Old man's gone. You know? I know, she says. How? Just old, he says, tucking his pistol away now. Wouldn't get out of bed, finally. Curled up there like a baby.
Clarice, she come to nurse him. She been a nurse, Clarice. Says when they turn to face the wall, that means it's over soon.
Chevette wants so badly to say something, but it will not come.
I like your hair, girl, Fontaine says, looking at her. Not so fierce now.
It's changing, Fontaine says, meaning the bridge and how they live on it. He's told her about the tendency to build these shops, how most of them are built with non-resident money, the owners hiring people to live there and maintain possession.
That lucky dragon, he says,
cupping a white china mug of his bitter, silted coffee.
That's there because someone decided the money was there for it to make. Tourists buying what they need to come out here. That wouldn't have happened before.
Why do you think it is? That it's changing?
It just is, he says. Things have a time, then they change.
Skinner, she says. He lived out his life here, didn't he? I mean, when this was all what it was. He was here for all of that. Here when they built it.
Not his whole life. Just the end of it.
That jacket you're wearing, he got that in England when he was younger. He lived there and rode motorcycles. Told me about it. Rode them up to Scotland, rode them all over, real old ones.
He told me a little about it once, she says. Then he came back here, and the little big one came, cracked the bridge. Pretty soon, he was out here.
Here, he says, I'll show you something. Opening a cabinet. Brings out a sheath knife, greenish handles inlaid with copper abstracts. Draws it from the waxed brown saddle leather, blade of Damascus steel tracked with dark patterns. The knife of Chevette's memories, its grip scaled with belt-ground segments of phenolic circuit board.
I saw that made, she says, leaning forward. Forged from a motorcycle drive chain, Vincent Black Lightning 1952. Rode that in England. It was a good 40 years old, too, then. Said there wasn't ever a bike to match it. Kept the chain till he found this maker.
Passes the knife to her. 5 inches of blade, 5 inches of handle.
Like you to have it.
Chevette runs her finger along the flat of the blade, a crocodile pattern of light and dark steel that had been formed as the links were beaten out.
I was thinking about this before, Fontaine. Today. How we went to where the smith worked, burned coke in an old coffee can.
Yes, I've seen it done, answered the chief.
But you need to sell this stuff, tries to hand it back. It wasn't for sale, he says. I was keeping it for you.
Fontaine has a strange boy in the shop's back room. Heavy, Hispanic, hair cut short. He sits the whole time cross-legged, his head in an old iPhone rig that looks like it came out of some military robotics dump, with a worn-out old notebook on his lap, endlessly, steadily clicking from one screen to the next.
Who's this?
She asks when they're back, Fontaine putting on a fresh pot of his terrible coffee, thinking the boy can hear her.
I don't know,
Fontaine says, turning to regard the boy in the iPhones.
He was outside this morning, breathing on my window.
Chevette looks at Fontaine, not getting it.
He likes watches,
Fontaine says, lighting the butane ring with a spark gun like a toy pistol.
Showed him how to hunt for watches this morning. Hasn't done much since.
Fontaine crosses to where the boy sits, looks down at him.
I'm not sure how much he understands English, Fontaine says, or he understands it, but it gets through funny.
Spanish, maybe?
I had Big Carlos by here, Fontaine says. Didn't seem to make much difference.
You live here now, Fontaine?
Yeah, he says. Not getting along with Clarice.
How's your kids?
They're okay. Hell, Tourmaline's okay, too, by anybody's standards but her own. I mean, not to live with, understand, but her health's pretty good.
Chevette picks up the sheathed Damascus boot knife and tries it in the inner zippered pocket of Skinner's jacket. It fit,
if you zipped the pocket shut, as far as you could, to hold it upright. What's he doing with your notebook?
He's hunting watches. I started him looking on the net auctions, but now he's looking everywhere. Gets places I don't understand how he does.
He gonna live here? Fontaine frowns.
I hadn't planned on it.
Chevette stands up, stretches, seeing the old man Skinner in memory, sitting up in his bed in the room atop the cable tower. What dancer she'd gotten off Creedmoor has long since worn off, leaving an edge of tiredness. Long day, very long day.
We're sleeping in a van down the foot of Folsom, she says.
You and who?
Tessa, friend of mine.
No, you're welcome here.
No, she says, Tessa'll be worried. I'm glad I saw you, Fontaine.
She zips the jacket.
Thank you for keeping his knife.
Whatever history it was she'd felt herself dodging, she hasn't found it. She just feels tired now. Otherwise, she doesn't seem to feel.
Your knife. Made it for you. Wanted you to have it. Told me.
Looking up from beneath his sparse gray dreadlocks now, and gently says,
asked us where you were, you know?
Her fit with history. And how that hurts. 39. Panopticon. Laney's progress through all the data in the world, or that data's progress through him, has long since become what he is, rather than something he merely does. The whole, that blankness at the core of his being, ceases to trouble him here. He is a man with a mission, though he readily admits to himself that he has no real idea what that mission may finally be. This all began, he reflects, knocking back his cough syrup in the amniotic darkness of his cardboard hutch, with his interest in Cody Harwood. The first prickings of the so-called stalker syndrome thought to eventually afflict every test subject ever dosed with 5SB. His initial reaction, of course, had been denial. This couldn't be happening to him, not after all these years. He was interested in Harwood, and for good reason. His awareness of the nodal points, the points from which change was emerging, would repeatedly bring Harwood to his attention. It was not so much that he was focusing on Harwood, as that things swung toward Harwood, gently, yet unavoidably, like the needle of a compass. His life at that point had been in stasis, employed by the management of Low Res, the pop group, to facilitate the singer Rez's marriage to the Japanese virtual star Rei Toei. Laney had settled into a life in Tokyo that centered around visits to a private, artificially constructed island in Tokyo Bay, an expensive nub of engineered landfill upon which Rez and Rei Toei intended to bring forth some sort of new reality. That Laney had never been able to quite grasp the nature of this reality hadn't surprised him. Rez was a law unto himself, very possibly the last of the pre-posthuman megastars, and Rei Toei, the Idoru, was an emergent system, a self continually being iterated from experiential input. Rez was Rez, and thereby difficult, and Rei Toei was that river into which one can never step twice. As she became more herself, through the inputting of experience, through human interaction, she grew and changed. Rez hadn't, and a psychologist employed by the band's management had confided in Laney that Rez, whom the psychologist characterized as having narcissistic personality disorder, wasn't likely to. I've met a lot of people, particularly in this industry, the psychologist had said, who have that. But I've never met one who had had it. So Laney had climbed, each working day, from a Tokyo dock into an inflatable Zodiac, to skim across the gray metallic skin of the bay to that nameless and perfectly circular island, and there to interact with, teach was not the word somehow, the Idoru. And what he had done, although neither of them had planned it, was to take her with him. Into that flow of information where he was most at home, or really farthest from his inner hole. He had shown her, as it were, the ropes, although they were not ropes that he or anyone else had names for. He had shown her nodal points in that flow, and they had watched together as change had emerged from these into the physical world. And he had never asked her how it was exactly that she intended to marry Rez, and he doubted that in any ordinary sense she knew. She simply continued to emerge, to be more present. And Lainey fell in love with her, although he understood that she had been designed for him and for the world to fall in love with. As the amplified reflection of desire, she was a team effort. To the extent that her designers had done their jobs properly, she was a waking dream, a love object sprung from an approximation of the global mass unconscious. And this was not, Lainey understood, a matter of sexual desire exclusively, though of course he felt that to his great confusion, but of some actual and initially painful opening of his heart. He loved her, and in loving her understood that his most basic sense of what that word might mean had changed, supplanting every previous concept, an entirely new feeling, and he had held it close, sharing it with no one, least of all the Idoro. And it had been toward the end of this that Cody Harwood, shy and smiling and gently elusive, someone Lainey had never felt the least interest in, had begun to obsess him. Harwood, most often depicted as a 21st century synthesis of Bill Gates and Woody Allen, had never previously been any more to Lainey than a vague source of irritation, one of those familiar icons who loom regularly on the horizons of media, only to drop away until they next appear. Lainey had had no opinion of Harwood, other than that he felt he had been glimpsing him all his life and didn't quite know why, and was vaguely tired of it. But as he spent more time cruising the aspects of the flow that were concerned with Harwood and with the activities of his firm, Harwood Levine, it had begun to become apparent that this was a locus of nodal points, a sort of meta-node, and that in some way he had been unable to define, something very large was happening here. His compulsive study of Harwood and things Harwoodian had led him to the recognition that history, too, was subject to the nodal vision, and the version of history that Lainey came to understand there bore little or no relation to any accepted version. He had been taught, of course, that history, along with geography, was dead. That history in the older sense was an historical concept. History in the older sense was narrative, stories we told ourselves about where we'd come from and what it had been like, and those narratives were revised by each new generation, and indeed always had been. History was plastic, was a matter of interpretation. The digital had not so much changed that as made it too obvious to ignore. History was stored data, subject to manipulation and interpretation. But the history Lainey discovered, through the quirk in his vision induced by having been repeatedly dosed with 5SB, was something very different. It was that shape, comprised of every narrative, every version. It was that shape that only he, as far as he knew, could see. At first, discovering this, he had attempted to share it with the Idoru. Perhaps, if shown, she, this post-human emergent entity, would simply start to see this way as well. And he had been disappointed when she had finally told him that what he saw was not there for her, that his ability to apprehend the nodal points, those emergent systems of history, was not there, nor did she expect to find it with growth. "This is human, I think," she'd said when pressed. "This is the result of what you are biochemically, being stressed in a particular way. This is wonderful. This is closed to me." And shortly after that, as her growing complexity continued to widen the distance he already knew she felt toward Rez, she had come to him and asked him to interpret the data as it flowed around herself and Rez, And he had done this, though reluctantly, out of love, knowing somehow he would be saying goodbye to her in the process. The flow around Rez and Rey was ripe with nodal points, particularly at those junctures where queerly occulted data poured steadily in from the walled city, that semi-mythical otherware of outlaw iconoclasts.
"Why have you connected with these people?" he'd asked. "Because I need them," she'd said. "I don't know why, but I know that I do. The situation does."
"Without them," he'd said, "you might not have a situation."
"I know," smiling.
But as his obsession with Harwood had deepened, Lainey had grown less comfortable with his trips to the island and their forays together into the fields of data. It had been as though he did not wish her to see him this way, his concentration warped from within, bent toward this one object, this strangely banal object. The sense of Harwood, of the information cloud he generated, swarmed in Lainey's dreams. And one morning, waking in the Tokyo hotel in which Lo Rez kept him billeted, he had decided not to go to work. And sometime after that, he knew from Yamazaki and from his own observation of the flow, the Idoru had departed Tokyo as well. He had his own theories about that, about her conversations with the denizens. They would have insisted on the term, he thought, of the digitally occluded walled city. And now, evidently, she was in San Francisco. Although he had known she would be, because of course she had to be, because San Francisco, he could see in the shape of things, was where the world ended, was ending. And she was a part of that, and so was he, and Harwood as well. But something would be decided, was being decided, there. And that was why he dared not sleep. Why he must send the suit, immaculate and malodorous, with his ankles tarred black, for regain and more of the blue syrup. Sometimes now, beyond the point of exhaustion, he has started to enter, for what may be seconds, but can feel like hours or days, some new mode of being. It is as though he becomes a single retina, distributed evenly across the inner surface of a sphere. Unblinking, he stares, globally, into that eye, seeing that with which he sees, while from a single invisible iris appear individual card-like images of Harwood, one after another. Yamazaki has brought him pillows and fresh sleeping bags, bottles of water, an unused change of clothes. He is vaguely aware of these things, but when he becomes the eye that looks in upon itself and upon the endless string of images, he has no awareness beyond that interiority, infinite and closed. End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.